supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. After the massacres at Virginia Tech, there was intense media coverage that raised many questions and, of course, pursued many answers. But what can we learn from the tragedy now that things on the outside have quieted down a bit? On today's show, we're going to take a look at two of the important issues that have come up in the wake of the attacks. First, social isolation, and then we're going to take a look at the mental health needs of students, what counseling is available, what counseling centers do on campuses. We'll start with social isolation. As we learned more about the perpetrator, the picture that emerged was that of a deeply troubled and lonely young man. Well, is there a relationship between social isolation, loneliness, and violence? Joining us now by phone is Dr. John Casipio. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Chicago. One of his specialties is the causes and consequences of social connection. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, is there a relationship between social isolation and violence? The profile of this perpetrator, Cho, reminded me of Columbine shooters and many of the others.
Yes, there is a commonality among these unfortunate cases. Recent analysis of what's common across individuals who have engaged in school violence is that they have been isolated individuals, even lonely individuals, for an extended period of time. I should point out, though, that another feature that's in common is that they're young males. That's probably a better predictor than feelings of isolation per se, so I don't want to exaggerate the impact of isolation over other factors. Having said that, though, there is work suggesting that isolation increases one's tendency to engage in antisocial or aggressive behavior toward other individuals.
I wonder why that is. You know, when I was preparing the interview, I thought back over my life, and I don't know if you're aware, I'm a quadriplegic, and right after my accident, during those first few months, I felt extraordinarily isolated, even though there was people around, supportive people, but I felt extraordinarily isolated, and now when I think back, I was really angry, and I wasn't aggressive, I don't think I would have been violent, but I was really angry. What is that connection?
We're a very social species, and when you're excluded from a group, that's a danger signal in an evolutionary sense. We're not particularly formidable species. We don't work well or adapt well in isolation. What makes us such a formidable species is our ability to think, plan, work together, communicate. So it's a very threatening circumstance to find yourself isolated from those about whom you care and those who can provide protection to you.
So who is at more risk? Certainly not everybody who's isolated is violent. Who's at more risk?
Well, Roy Baumeister and June Twenge have conducted a really interesting series of studies in which they have experimentally made people feel isolated. Specifically, what they've done is to give individuals feedback about their personality that was constructed. Isn't factually accurate, but they allowed them to randomly assign people to be told that later in life they would be isolated, living alone, lose their friends and connections to other people. They had a control condition in which people were told some other negative event would characterize the rest of their life. So they tried to just control for how negative does their future appear to be. What they found was that those who were told that they would live an isolated life were also more likely to aggress or use intense shocks when trying to teach another individual. They also ate more sugar. They were more likely to not regulate themselves along a number of dimensions that we think of when we think of orderly, well-regulated behavior.
So we can see the impact of isolation. I just wonder what flips that over to violence.
Right. The most recent study out of that group has shown that a fairly simple manipulation, just a positive regard, a favor done, a kind act, in these experimental subjects can diminish their aggressiveness toward others. That's a very weak manipulation in the first place. With these cases that we're talking about are ones in which these individuals have lived in a chronic state of loneliness and isolation for an extended period of time. In both cases, there's been a record that they have logged of prior insults and ostracism. That's a little more resistant, and you can imagine how that might build up to place someone at risk for violence.
Well, much as I didn't want to talk about Cho per se here, this most recent perpetrator, you talk about, you know, an act of kindness, reaching out, can diminish one's sense of social isolation. Apparently, there were plenty of people who've reached out to him. So it raises a question in my mind: are there people who choose social isolation? Is there kind of a personality or character that is going to tend to go that way?
Well, Cho is an unusual case, I believe. There is a record of mental disorders that dates back longer than in other cases to which you referred. And I know the second part of your program, you're going to be dealing with the mental health needs of individuals. People tend not to choose psychopathology. They tend to be struck by this, just like they don't choose physical diseases. And so I'm not sure we want to generalize beyond him, but it is the case most people who suffer isolation are able to find at least sufficient relief that their aggression is controlled.
I'm a little concerned about the trend in this country, which is moving towards increasing social isolation. The number of people we call intimate friends has diminished from 4 to 3, I think, over the last decade or two. Some 25% of us are living alone?
Right. You're exactly right. The number of contacts, frequency of contacts, has gone down over the last 20 years. In 1984, the Social Science Survey indicated that the modal number of respondents had three intimate confidants, and in the most recent analysis in 2004, the modal response was no confidence, zero confidence. That's a dramatic change. If you look at the demography of the United States, just in the past 30 years, there's been about almost a 30% increase in the number of people living alone. Some of that's due to aging, but as you suggest, much of that's also due to other demographic changes in our society.
People who are socially isolated aren't necessarily lonely, but they're more likely to be. So how do you define loneliness, and what are its implications?
Yeah, loneliness is defined as perceived isolation. So you're exactly right. In studies that we've done looking at population-based samples, the number of contacts people actually have, the frequency with which they're around other people, is only weakly related to their feelings of isolation. I mean, it is related, but it's weakly related to feelings of isolation. For the most part, we're around people in everyday life. That doesn't mean, however, that we feel we have connection with those individuals. We've all perhaps moved residences across long geographic boundaries and felt we were around a lot of people, but we no longer had the connections that we seek in other individuals.
So this also gets to the issue of feeling lonely in a relationship.
And right.
I also wonder about loneliness. We know can sometimes be a symptom of depression or social anxiety, and really might not have much to do at all with social isolation.
And that's true. We have done a longitudinal study to examine that question. Other researchers had found a correlation between isolation, loneliness, and depression, and we were able to look across time to see if the isolation at perceived isolation at one point in time predicted changes, increases in depression, or whether feelings of depression at an earlier point in time predicted increases in loneliness. What we found was that there was a causal relationship both direction. That is, that your feelings of isolation now increased the likelihood you would become depressed, whereas your feelings of depression now increased the likelihood that you would become lonely at a later point in time. So we see this really interesting pernicious cycle between the two. You get lonely, you feel worse, you go into depression, or if you feel depressed, you withdraw from others, and you become lonelier.
Mm. Is there a certain personality type that is more likely to be socially isolated, or personal characteristics?
There certainly are personality characteristics that suggest you are likely to interact with many or fewer individuals. Extroversion is one such personality factor. However, it is only very weakly related to perceived isolation. An introvert may have fewer contacts, but they also need fewer confidants in order to feel like they're integrated or connected with other people.
Hmm. What about other factors? One's physical appearance, or?
That's a great question. We have looked at and worried that loneliness might be a function of relatively superficial features like physical appearance, weight, height, and we found in a study of undergraduate students that there was no association whatsoever between physical attractiveness or height or weight, or for that matter, intelligence.
Say that again. There's no relationship. I'm shocked here.
I was as well. We found no association between loneliness and physical appearance, attractiveness, height, weight, or even intelligence in an undergraduate sample of men and women.
So I'm having trouble I'm having trouble integrating it. It just doesn't fit with anything that makes sense in my head. So how do people who are isolated then contribute to their own isolation?
That's an excellent question. What partly the process is one of social cognition, how they think about other people. If I'm lonely, I'm also likely to fear. I mean, I want to connect with another individual, but I also fear rejection from that individual. And so I'm going to engage in self-protective behavior because it hurts to be rejected. Interpreting ambiguous behaviors as if it was meant for rejection so that I protect myself from that rejection. But I paradoxically fulfill the prophecy that I'm going to be rejected by doing that.
And I guess my choice then is if I perceive myself as isolated, then either I am isolated because they are bad or because I'm defective.
Right, exactly. And so it's more adaptive to think that it must be someone else's fault.
Yeah, and that's just going to reinforce the isolation. Do you think this is part of what was going on in Virginia with Virginia Tech?
It's difficult because that being a single case, whereas I tend to operate it at the level of group data from experiments.
All right, I'll be more reasonable with you. Let's expand it. What can be done?
Well, I think the second part of your program is one step we need to take, and that is we need to pay more attention to perceived isolation, to loneliness. We know that this has health consequences, physical health consequences, not only mental health consequences. The notion that this is somehow all in their head and they need to get over it is not a reasonable response. We now know that these are processes people would like to get over, but they simply can't on their own. And so greater attention to the needs of such individuals. And the concern, as you raised, about the direction of our society and the implications that has for future such individuals is something we need to take notice of and start doing something about.
Well, there was an article that came out to make matters worse in the end of April in USA Today about how children with mental illnesses are perceived by adults in our society, and the picture's not good. I mean, the stigma is worse than ever now. So you know, it's going to be harder to reach out to these kids, and they might be less likely to be open.
But clearly, if we fail to reach out and do something more adaptive, we're going to be in for more tragedies in the future.
How can we do it? How can we, an individual, a teacher, reach out to a child who seems isolated? I wouldn't think the first step would be to send them to a counseling center or a therapist.
No, I agree with you. I think we have to recognize some of the changes that we see in our society. We have to recognize that whereas 20 or 30 years ago, people had highly integrated friends and family, extended families living in the same circumstance, so there was lots of closely connected individuals to whom students or young adults could turn. We are less likely to be in that circumstance now. So that teacher in the past may not have been the one confidant the student might have. We're moving toward a circumstance where that teacher may indeed be the most important contact that student has if they have problems. And so we need to just be aware of those changes as a starting point.
Well, what you are saying really underscores something I preach about a lot, the importance of volunteering in public schools and just having adults there just to hang out. It really can save a life.
Right.
Well, I want to thank you so much for your time, for your work, and sharing what you've learned with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Dr. John Cacioppo is a professor of psychology at the University of Chicago. One of his specialties is the causes and consequences of social connection. Well, coming up, we're going to discuss students and mental health counseling centers, what they do, and what they provide. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Penn supports WHYY. Doctors at Penn's Depression Research Unit are providing evaluations to determine if you are suffering from depression. Symptoms may include mood swings, irritability, sleep disturbance, and lack of interest. Those who qualify may receive an initial examination and treatment with an investigational antidepressant for 3 to 12 months. For information, the DRU number at Penn is 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
Hi, this is Bill Morazzo, president of WHYY, and I'd like to thank all of you who contributed during our May membership drive. Look, you make it possible. Great reporting, in-depth interviews, and analysis that enriches all of us in our community. As you head into the election booth this Tuesday, know that WHYY has helped you make an informed decision through the Next Mayor Project. Keep listening to 91 FM and visit WHYY.org. It certainly is radio worth your time and your support.
And welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. After the massacre at Virginia Tech, many parents and reporters kept asking if the shooting could have been prevented. Teachers and fellow students have repeatedly urged Cho to seek help at a college counseling center, but he refused to go. And then in 2005, he was hospitalized for being a possible danger to himself, but he was released just the following day. So could the college have done more to identify him as a threat? What is the role of college counselors in general? The demands on college counselors have increased over the last decade. More and more students are seeking help from counseling centers with more severe and complicated problems. Well, joining me now are two counseling center directors, John Domino and Maggie Gartner. Domino is director of Temple University's Tuttleman Counseling Center. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Maggie Gartner is director of student counseling services at Texas A&M. She's also director of the Association for University and College Counseling Center Directors, which represents over 700 institutions across the United States. Maggie, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I want to ask both of you, I'll start with you, John, a personal question. When you heard about Virginia Tech and the fallout, what was your initial reaction?
It was a horrifying day. I think that many people felt traumatized by hearing this and sort of put themselves in the place of the people who were at Virginia Tech.
Whose place did you put yourself in?
Well, that's a good question. I was thinking of that college counseling center director who was interviewed by the media, and there was a lot of scrutiny both of campus safety services at that time as well as counseling services, not only by the media but by the institutions themselves. I think the institutions, to try to prevent or such incidents in the future, quickly mobilized and started asking questions about, could something like this happen here, and how could we prevent it?
Maggie, let me ask you the same question. What was your first gut reaction?
Oh, my heart just sank to my toes. And Chris Flynn, who's the director at Virginia Tech, and I thought instantly of Chris, and I knew the stress and the attention, the work that they were going to have to do. I knew all these things that were coming to them, and my heart just went out to the whole counseling center, but especially to Chris, who had lived through Katrina in New Orleans. He was a director in New Orleans when Katrina came through, and it's just an awful experience.
To a certain extent, I guess I'll ask you both this, and then I want to get off to specifics about counseling. Do you both live with this background fear that this could happen, and am I prepared? Start with you, John.
Well, I think every college counseling center, the face of college counseling has changed pretty dramatically in the last decade or so, and I think a lot of people are proactively looking for ways to try to avoid various crises, including people who are dangerous to themselves or others, and ways to help those people.
Maggie, is it there for you? Is it in the back of your mind, the pit of your stomach?
Always. I always worry about our students, and I know every counseling center director does. We worry about the ones that are on the edge. We worry about the ones and take them home with us. We try not to, but we do. We do everything. I agree with John. We do everything we can to be prepared. We do everything we can to address the social isolation piece and to address the issues that our students face. And yet we know, just like in the case of Virginia Tech, that we have very little legal power to make students get services, to make them do anything, really, to continue counseling unless they're what we call an imminent harm situation. And so it's very difficult.
You said you do everything you can to mm-hmm. prepare. What is that?
Well, we do a program here called QPR, which is Question, Persuade, Refer. And that program helps deal with suicide assessment. And it, essentially, it makes eyes and ears of everyone on the whole campus. It makes them eyes and ears of the counseling center because it teaches them what to look for, what to ask, how to talk about suicide or other kinds of issues, and how to get them help and get them into the counseling center. So we've been doing that for 3 years with pretty great success. Faculty and staff like it. We train students also. And they can have then something in their tool belt to deal with students that they're concerned about. Because I have 46,000 students here. I have 27 direct service providers. That's not enough. I mean, think about how many that is. And Texas A&M is extremely supportive of this. Most counseling centers, I had some data for you from the survey that we just finished. The ratio of mental health professionals to students on campus averages 1 to 1,647 students.
That's pretty frightening. Let me turn to you, John. How many counselors do you have, and how many students?
Well, we have 12 full-time counselors. Then we have other people who do mostly outreach. We have 36,000 students. Temple has just made a commitment to hire another full-time psychiatrist, which I'm very happy about. And we do something similar to what Maggie's describing. We've had a referral guide for faculty and staff for about 8 years now, which is also available on our website. And it goes into great detail to describe the kinds of warning signs that faculty and staff would want to look at that would trigger a referral to counseling services.
What services do you provide?
We provide mostly individual counseling. We also provide group counseling, and that's another very important piece of College Counseling Center's repertoire, especially in light of what Dr. Casipia was saying in terms of the social isolation. We have a strong group program at Temple, and we try to get many students into those groups so that they can start being able to communicate feelings and not feel as isolated. In fact, we've had several groups that are focused specifically on people who appear as shy or people who have social phobia and so forth. But we also have other groups for substance abusers as well.
How many people do you see a year?
We see about 1,500 students a year in counseling. We see many thousands more in our workshops and outreach events and educational programming, but traditional counseling is about 1,500.
1,500.
Yes.
So do the math for me. You've got 12. You've got 12 counselors.
Yeah, it's quite a heavy load, and we have there are other things in addition to adding staff. I think it's important that all universities look at what the resource allocation is in light of, you know, what can happen if things go wrong. But in addition to that, we moved to a walk-in clinic format about 4 years ago, and that's been really important in terms of our ability to have a very open front door and quickly assess people and to have a clinician making the decisions. Before we moved to that format, basically, we had students showing up saying it was an emergency, and some were true psychiatric emergencies, but others were that their grade wasn't as good as they wanted. So that would be very disruptive. And so the walk-in clinic format is a true triage system, which enables a clinician to briefly assess people and get them the level of care. So if it's urgent, they'll be seen that day or the next day.
Tell me why students do come to you, how they get to you.
Well, a variety of ways. I think the one that's most often endorsed by students is that they're self-referred. We get out at orientation, and we came up with a kind of creative way to engage students at orientation to destigmatize counseling services. We created a film using Temple students themselves so that other incoming students can see people who are a little older than them talking about issues like anxiety and depression and other issues that are important.
When they do come to you, why do they come? What do they present with, to use the lingo?
The three most often endorsed symptoms, if you will, are depression, anxiety, and relationship conflicts, which might be family relationship from their family of origin, as well as romantic relationship problems. That's held steady for quite some time in terms of the percentages of students who have those particular complaints.
But I'm saying, but I don't want to force an idea in your head. The nature of the students you work with, you've been there 11 years. The nature of the students you work with has changed according to everything I've read.
Yeah, that's true. Many more students are arriving on campus with prior psychiatric histories, medication needs, and the seriousness of the problems has increased. And so we have to do a lot more case management with students who have crises in their lives and who might be in danger. And we do a lot of intensive case conferencing of those students on a weekly basis, and the entire staff is involved in those conferences so that we can utilize each other's expertise.
Maggie, I'd like to get your perspective nationally on how students have changed over the last, say, decade.
Well, I've been a counseling center director since 1991, and during that time, what I've seen and what we see across the country, just as John said, is an increase in pathology of those coming through the door, significant prior histories of treatment and or psychotropic medication, but there's more severity coming through our doors all the time.
A couple of years ago, four NYU students jumped to their deaths. Suicide seems to be on the increase. There's questions about contagion of suicide. There's lots of other self-destructive behaviors. There was a study out of Princeton where 17% of girls are cutting themselves. And other forms of self-mutilation. I wonder, I'll start with you from a national perspective, Maggie. Are counselors equipped to deal with this?
I think by and large, most counseling centers are staffed by very strong professionals who are committed to working with college students. So I think, yes, we are, but it also gets overwhelming.
You mean the volume?
Yes.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about how your counselors get trained at Temple, please.
Well, most of the counselors at Temple are licensed psychologists, either clinical psychologists or counseling psychologists. We have some licensed social workers, and we have a licensed psychiatrist. So I agree with Maggie that the caliber of the people who work in college counseling centers, by and large, is very good. What happens, though, is it is overwhelming because of the volume and the intensity. And also, college settings have a great deal of scrutiny. Everyone hears about it if there is some legal action that's taking against a university based on what treatment they did or didn't receive, so that adds to the intensity of that setting. I had worked in community mental health before this, and I thought I had seen just about everything, but there are other challenges that occur in a college setting that make it quite an intense place to work.
Hmm. Maggie, has life on campus changed over the last 20 years? Increased social isolation, I wonder about the great pressure to achieve? Is bullying worse? What kinds of changes are today's children living with that perhaps we didn't?
The interesting thing is that when you ask John what the three most common things coming in with, that's the same thing everybody says: depression, anxiety, and relationship issues. But what we're seeing more is an increase in the severity of what presents, as well as there's a pressure for students to succeed, to find a job, to do well. And I told your assistant, the students hear from their parents, these are the best years of your life. And I tell the parents, what are you telling them? It's all downhill from here? That's not a good thing. That's not a good message. This is a very stressful time, and students are really wanting to succeed. They want to do well. There's tremendous competition for good grades. And so I think the issues are probably the same as what they've been, but they've been ratcheted up. More pressure, more stress, more confusion about what they want to do and how they want to do it. How can you succeed?
Hmm. Of course, what you are suggesting is perhaps part of it is parental involvement and the pressure that comes from home, and I've seen that on all across the economic continuum. The kids who are from middle class, upper middle class, they get this tremendous pressure to be perfect, and those who might be the first in their family to go to college feel as though they're carrying their family on their shoulder. Are you seeing that kind of stress, John?
Yes, there was an article in the Philadelphia Inquirer last week that amazed me, and it was about how many college students, as they're graduating, are relying on their parents to help them in their job search. And they talked about what a change that is that's happened over time. Then at Temple, we get many students who are first-generation college goers who are a little bit more economically challenged, let's say, who have more difficulty making ends meet. They might be working a job or two in addition to going to school. And so that adds a great deal of stress as well. They might be the pride of their family, as you were suggesting. And then you have parents from the baby boomer generation who have been termed helicopter parents, who might be hovering a little bit too much and making it hard for the student to negotiate their separation, both from the family and then to also to form their own identity, so to speak, which are two very important developmental issues at that time of life, as well as intimacy with others. So the amount of I think that the amount of involvement varies from family to family, but in general, I think this generation has been characterized as one in which there's a great deal of hovering. In fact, one director comically coined the term military helicopter parents to talk about the ones who are extremely involved.
And despite the helicoptering going on, there really is a lack of intimacy that a lot of children complain about. They feel unknown and isolated from their family. So they really are two different things. Our phone numbers are 888-477-9499. We have a couple of lines open, and we're going to be going to the phones. We're talking about the mental health of our college students, what counseling centers are doing, can be doing, should be doing, and what our kids are living with on college campuses. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Let's go to Mark on line two.
Hello.
Hi, Mark.
Hey, Dan. It's a wonderful program. Thank you for taking my call. Dan, the reason I'm calling, I'm a professor of counseling at the College of New Jersey. I train many of the professionals who take the kinds of positions like your guests on this show. And I really ache for them because their hands are tied by important policy decisions that need to be changed. You know, historically, there was a time when if someone had a mental illness, they could be very badly abused by the system. So we developed all sorts of safeguards to protect the rights of people who had a mental illness. But in my opinion, we've gone too far in the other direction, and it's clearly indicated in this case. This young man who killed all of those people down in Virginia Tech had a long history of psychiatric illness, and the professionals did everything they could to try and help him, yet by law there was only so far they could go. And if we look just a couple years ago, there was a case in New York, a very very tragic case. A boy named Eddie Warner was murdered when a youth he happened to go up to this house, and some youth there who also had years of problems took him in and strangled him. So my point is that until some important policy issues are addressed, individuals like this young man are going to continue to isolate themselves, and their illness will go untreated, and they'll be at risk to hurt others.
Boy, that's really an interesting point. I think it's the point. I'm going to turn to my guests, and, you know, this gets at the issue that we argue around the Homeland Security Act. You know, what do we do for security, and how far do we go, and where do we compromise, you know, civil rights and human rights? Who wants to take a crack at that? John?
Okay, I could start. I think you really have to balance the needs of the community and the importance of filling the environment with helpers who will kind of see who's in trouble and get them the help that they need. And also, one of the foundations of the field of counseling, which is the assurance that your communications are confidential when you talk to a counselor. And why else would you talk to someone about your deepest, darkest secrets or the things that are troubling you the most if you weren't assured that it was going to be confidential? But federal and state law also says that if a person becomes a danger to themselves or others, that it is then incumbent upon the counselor to make sure that they act and they get that person to safety or get them the treatment that they need. So there's a real balancing act that needs to be done.
Well, and then you talk about danger to self or others. I mean, it's a very narrow window that we have to get through before we can get somebody hospitalized involuntarily. And then what? You know, we have 24 hours
right.
or 48 between the law and managed care restrictions. And what's going to happen in 24 hours?
Absolutely.
The other piece that I would say is if you have a student who is coming to us and telling us that they're going to harm themselves or someone else, have we put, and we put strictures on that to say, well, we're going to tell, legally, we have to do it if there's an imminent harm situation. But if we say there's one that we're a little worried about or we're concerned about and we're going to have to tell that one, will they quit coming in? How many have we already nipped in the bud as opposed to how many we may if we open that gate?
So what's the answer, Maggie?
Well, I think number one, there is no guarantee of a safe campus, no matter what you do and how you do it. As long as we have open campuses, we don't have walls around our campuses. We don't have guards at the entrance. I was an exchange person in China last year at Zhao Tong University in Xi'an. There were guards. There were soldiers with weapons at the entrance. We don't have that in America. So as long as we don't have that, and we can't guarantee safety, there's no way we can do it. We do the very best we can. And I agree with everything John has said about how we have to get out there and what we do with outreach and how we get the students in and encourage professors to check on their students and consult with us. But at the bottom line is there is no guarantee that campuses are going to be any safer than any place else in America.
Would you want to see any change in policy legislation?
I have real concerns that if we open that gate to confidentiality, that it's no longer confidential, or it's confidential as long as you don't talk about any of this other stuff, then we're going to miss some of the students that we could really help, and that they may just not tell us and go out and do something.
You think the problems that would create would be greater than the things we would solve?
Exactly.
Huh. I really agree with what Maggie said, and I want to return to a point you mentioned, Dan, which is really on a broader social level, what are insurance companies willing to pay for in terms of treatment? How long are hospital stays these days? If you talk to practitioners from 20 years ago, they feel it's disgraceful what kind of treatment students get at hospitals and how long they're able to stay there. And that's not necessarily a fault of the hospital, but more about managed care and those kinds of forces in society that are creating this bind. And if the and it doesn't mean that a hospitalization solves all ills. I'm not of that opinion, but there has to be enough treatment there when a person is that desperate and in that much need of help.
Well, that's the topic of another show, one we've done, one we will do again. I'm one of those people who've been out there for 20 years, and I am frustrated and I am ashamed of the way our culture has treated people with mental illness.
Here.
We'll talk a bit more. We'll talk a bit more about that next week. Let me reintroduce you and take a break. And we've got a lot of people who want to join the conversation. We're talking about college campuses and our kids, what we are doing for their mental health, what college counselors are doing. My guests are Dr. John Domino, he's director of Temple University's Tuttleman Center, and Maggie Gartner, she's director of Student Counseling Service at Texas A&M. She's also director of the National Organization for College and Counseling Center Directors. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM. When a child has a mental illness, the whole family is affected. Parents struggle to find the right schools, medication, and therapy. Siblings feel neglected. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Join us for the next In the Spirit of Family panel discussion when we explore how families can deal with mental illness in their children. That's Wednesday, May 16th at 6 p.m. here at WHYY. For more information or to register, please visit whyy.org.
Next time on Day to Day.
Moon Pie Madness. That was pretty bad. Let's try that again.
Long nights, endless brainstorming sessions.
Tired is not the word. Sleeping on the furniture is more appropriate.
It's a place that looks and operates like a major ad agency.
But it's not. It's the top advertising school in the country.
Watching a student presentation, you do get goosebumps.
Training to make the perfect pitch.
Get your own box.
Next time on Day to Day. This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about counseling centers on college campuses, what they do, what they need to do, and what services are available. Joined by Dr. Maggie Gartner, who's Director of Student Counseling at Texas A&M, and Dr. John Domino, who's Director of the Tuttleman Counseling Services here at Temple University. And we've got a lot of people on the phones who want to join the conversation. Let's start with Neva. I hope I pronounced your name correctly. Yes, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. What can we do for you?
The reason I was calling was I work with an organization by the name of Horizon House.
Yes.
And we have an education program for individuals who have a mental health disability. And we've been working with them. We're a mobile program. And we work with the students on helping them to access education and any personal issues that they may have arising on a college campus. And I can tell you our program's been very effective in that when the students have issues around going to classes or feeling isolated and situations like that, we have groups that we encourage the students to go to. And the students have really done very well. A lot of them have a 3.0 average, and they're able to access this additional supports that they may not get because a lot of times they don't want to access the supports on the college campus.
So,
you know, they're afraid, even though it's supposed to be confidential. A lot of times they're afraid to do that.
Sure. It's, you know, a lot of people don't want to seek counseling right in their own neighborhood. How does one access your program?
Well, I have the number if you would like for me to give it to you.
We'll take it.
Okay. The number is 215-471-4015.
All right, we'll put that up on the webpage. What's the name of the program?
It's called Education Plus.
Okay.
And we also have a program for youth that want to go to college who haven't been able to attain that level of education yet, and that's called Education Plus Youth.
All right, that's great. Thanks so much. Thanks so much for your call, and thanks so much for the work you do. We got a call who didn't stay on the line, and I want to turn this to you, John, who's talked about social anxiety and his anxiety about even seeking counseling, this level of shyness. I know you set programs up at Temple to promote mental health and not just treat mental illness. What do you have going on there?
Well, we have a number of really good programs that involve students in community service that I've been able to branch out into, and these are programs that are just helpful for the people who mentor the students as well as the students themselves. So, for instance, we started a community garden in North Philadelphia, and some of the people who are socially phobic got involved in that, as well as others, many others, people who had DUIs and needed to do some community service got involved with that. And we asked the elders on the street what they needed, and they talked about how we had this beautiful mural in honor of Sonia Sanchez, who's a former Temple faculty, and there was a vacant lot in front of it, and so the community got together and did that. There are many programs where we take students across the country. This Saturday, I'm going with a group to the Rosebud Indian Reservation in South Dakota, and we've set up some work projects there.
Wait a minute. I'm going back to Temple. How do you do that? How do you set that up? How do you get funding?
I think, well, especially in light of what we've been talking about, how counselors are overworked these days, to me, this helps everyone's mental health, including mine. And what we're trying to do is we're mentoring these students. We're teaching them how to go into a place that might be, you know, where people are struggling, and figure out ways that they can make a difference. And this has a huge impact on our students. They write essays afterwards, and it becomes something that develops people as whole persons, not just intellectually, but spiritually, emotionally, and physically.
I think that's great. You know, we talked about helicopter parents and the pressure on these kids. One of the things they lose in this process is locus of control. They lose the sense that they really can have an impact on their world, and programs like that changes that. Sounds like a great program. Maggie, I just want to ask you, in conclusion, what needs to happen on a national level to make things better?
Well, one of the things that I wanted to share was some information nationally that 59.1% of centers reported that their operating budgets remained the same or actually decreased. And we need to do something about that. We need to ensure that there's enough service providers, competent service providers for our students. But the other thing that you touched on and I strongly agree with is there needs to be some community resources out there to help our students. We can't do it all. We got to work together. And so I would strongly encourage that there be more funding in the communities for services to everyone for mental health needs.
Well, and I'm also a big fan of volunteerism, and mm-hmm. one of the things I nag people about is, you know, instead of complaining about what everybody else is not doing, get out there. You can do an enormous amount of good volunteering on campuses, even at counseling centers in the community. That there's nothing better for prevention than having contact with an adult who has time to hang out with you and learn about you
and listen to you.
Listening is everything. That's what we learned the first course for all of us in graduate school. Listening is everything. I want to thank you both so much for joining us today on Voices in the Family.
Thank you so much.
What you've had to say is informative at some levels and at other levels troubling. So thank both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dan.
Maggie Gortner is Director of Student Counseling Services at Texas A&M. She's also Director of the Association for University and College Counseling Center Directors. John Domino is Director of the Tuttling Counseling Services at Temple University. Earlier on, we heard from John Casipio. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Chicago and specializes in social connection and social isolation. For that program, Education Plus, the number is 215-471-4015. Join us this coming Wednesday, May 16th, for a special In the Spirit of Family. My panel and I will discuss options for children affected by mental illness. For more information on that, log on to www.whyy.org. It's Wednesday from 6 until 8 o'clock. Well, the engineer for today's show's been Fred Snyder. Shane Ewing is our new intern. Welcome to the team, Shane. Christine Dempsey is our executive producer. Alisa Walters is our associate producer. And Voices in the Family is produced by Mike and Scott. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Enjoy your week, my friends.